Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Code Through Vine for December 11th, 2011. I'm your host, David McLaughlin, and join me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Good evening, y'all.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Yeah, good to have y'all on. And just before we get talking, I want to kind of do a little preview of our guests. First time we'll have ever had Brad Crone from North Carolina come on, but Brad is quite an expert on North Carolina. For those of you in Georgia that are familiar with the Georgia Gang, he is one of the panelists on a North Carolina-type show, discusses North Carolina politics, longtime expert, I believe worked for the Speaker of the House. We'll let Brad do a true bio of himself when he gets on here, but certainly an expert, and so we'll get all the ins and outs of North Carolina, a state that does have a gubernatorial election in addition to being, you know, maybe if not a swing state, that next category down below in the presidential race. So that should be exciting. And until that time, we're going to discuss probably one of the saddest stories of the political year, and that was the apparent suicide of Robert Brown. I just happened to click on real quickly, I guess, to AJC before I started teaching on Friday morning and saw that and was pretty shocked by it. Catherine, what did you think when you first saw that or heard of it?
Well, it was very sad. I was actually at the Metro Atlanta and Fulton Dems holiday party at the DPG headquarters, and when I walked in to help prepare and set up, the news had just come through, and so I think we all, you know, had a moment of silence during the party, and it did, you know, of course, as you would expect, put a damper on the party, but a lot of people were very upset, people who had been friends with him and had worked with him, and it's just very sad, and I'm sorry for his family and those who knew him well. It's very, very sad, especially before the holidays and all. It's just, he was quite a powerhouse, and we'll all miss him.
Yeah, Tim, when did you first learn of it, and what was your thoughts?
Well, the first thing I saw of it was Jason Carter threw it up on his Facebook page, it was sad. He had a nickname, you know, Straight No Chaser. He was known as a man of unwavering convictions. And he was known to be someone who told it like he saw it. It's sad that he's gone. He gave 20 good years to this state. He was a champion of the poor. He was a great supporter of things like the Hope Scholarship. He was the first African-American, I believe, elected to the state Senate from Bibb County since Reconstruction. His tragic death does leave a big hole in state politics, David, and it's just all my best goes out to his surviving family.
Yes, I had met him through my work with the Democratic Party of Georgia. Wouldn't say I really knew him. I knew about him. I mean, obviously, I think he recognized my face, and I certainly didn't recognize his when I'd see him at different things. But I do get the sense that he was a man that his entire life revolved around politics. And when he decided to give up the state Senate seat and then run for the mayor of Macon, then when he didn't win that race, and I don't think it was so much losing, it was that he had this, you know, huge empty hole in his life because there wouldn't be any politics in some period of time. Also, I heard it mentioned about some health issues.
Yeah.
May have been in great pain. I mean, obviously, no one knows why,
but I think of the song by, I guess, Fleetwood Mac, First Landslide, I Built My Life Around You. And this is a man that built his life around politics. And this is, you know, this is three incidents now either that that we kind of point to. Nancy Schaefer, that was her husband that killed her and then killed himself. Then Glenn Richardson, after he resigned in shame, if you will, apparently seriously contemplated suicide. Are these two, at least two of these tragedies, in any way related, or are they just separate people and separate incidents, do you think? Catherine?
Oh, I would be unwilling to say that they're all connected. I think, you know, politics is a hard scrabble business, and I think it is a lot more divisive than it has been. I mean, I say that. I think it's just more visibly divisive. I think it's always been pretty divisive, but I think, you know, these are all individuals, and they've had, you know, we all have tragedies in our lives, and we all respond to them differently, and I wouldn't want to hazard a guess about that.
Yeah, Tim, any thoughts on, you know, the role that not having politics could have played?
Well, it could have had some role, but who can really explain, you know, something like depression? You know, David, who knows whose breaking point is where? I would imagine the severe health issues, and he has had some of those for the last 4 or 5 years, probably had as much to do with it as the void that was left by politics. It's just, especially when someone leaves no word as to why, it's just something that, you know, everyone will just always speculate on.
Yeah, and I don't bring this up to gossip or rumor monger or anything else. The reason I'm bringing it up is because, of course, they talk a lot about when athletes, their careers get over, the suicide rate is higher than the average population. Apparently cricket is a really high suicide rate when players in that career. And they do studies because they say if you learn why, you can prevent it for the next people. And obviously two, maybe three cases don't really make a trend. But, and this is just in one state. Now, they may look at all these other states, and there may be more people, and there may be some, you know, reason to study this. I mean, that's why I bring it up, because if you can't learn from, you know, tragedy, then, you know, the tragedy really is senseless and always. I know Tony Dungy, his son committed suicide, and he talked about how it really is sad if he can't, you know, do anything to help anybody else, and he's talked about it since his son's suicide, how he's done things to help people, and he feels at least there's some good that came out of that, you know, horrible tragedy. So I look at it from that means.
Well, it was interesting at the Fulton. At the Fulton meeting, we were talking about it, and there was a woman there who is a 10-year cancer survivor, and she said, "Oh, I wish she had spoken to me, because I would have told him that you can get through anything if you look at it in the right way." So, you know, but for, I don't know if he had cancer. I don't know what his illnesses were, but, you know, I think we all want to help people. And I think you make a good point, David, that if we can examine why these things happen, that maybe we can stop them from happening in the future.
You know, one person he talked to a lot was Cynthia McKinney, and she went into that with an in-depth interview. He never, in all these months leading up to his death, even gave her any indication that he was thinking of anything like that. So this was something he chose to do privately and never shared with anyone. So,
yeah, I mean, it's certainly tragic, and you know, it's hard to know what to make of it, and obviously the people of Macon lost some. Because even if he decided never to run for office, given his expertise, his experiences, he could have probably done great work for Macon, Georgia. in the future. And one final thing before we move on off of this and move on to our guest of the evening, I do want to say, I guess thank you is not the word, or, you know, something that, about Peach Pundit. When Charlie Harper did two posts over there, he closed the comments. And I know in the past on Peach Pundit, when something's, you know, somewhat related to a Democrat or maybe a divisive figure amongst his readers, that some comments had been off color, if you will. And he had the good foresight to see that and close the comments. And I want to give him kudos for that, if you will, showing that he's a very level-headed individual that wants to have, I think, more of a highbrow sight than some of his commenters might like.
And
I agree with you 100%. I thought it was very classy. What he wrote and what they closed the comments. I thought he was really classy about it.
Yeah, I did notice that right off. Well, let's go ahead and move on to something maybe more forward-looking. And Brad Crone has come on with us, and like I alluded to, this is an expert in North Carolina politics. And, Brad, we want to bring you on. And I've told the people a little bit, but I want you to kind of give us a better view of your background.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm an expert, but I've been around for a long time. I was in the newspaper business. I went to school at NC State and graduated from there in 1984. My father was involved in North Carolina politics, dating all the way back to the 1960 race where he and former United States Senator Robert Morgan worked together on I. Beverly Lake Senior's campaign against Terry Sanford in the Democratic Party primary. So I have deep roots in the conservative pro-business wing of the Democratic Party. I got my experience in North Carolina politics working for Locke Faircloth when he was a Democrat. He was the Commerce Secretary under Governor Jim Hunt in his first and second terms and ran for governor as a pro-business Democrat in 1984, lost the primary to the Attorney General Rufus Edmonston and the Mayor of Charlotte, Eddie Knox, and they had a primary runoff. And I went back to work in the radio business, but it was a great experience. First day I showed up for work for Locke Faircloth, he got me in the car, which was a Delta 88 Oldsmobile, and there are three rules that I have. He said, rule number one, I don't watch TV. Rule number two, I don't listen to the radio. And in rule number three, you don't never, ever remove one of my car keys out of my car. I said, either leave it in the ignition or underneath the floor mat. I said, Mr. Faircloth, I got rule one and rule two, but I don't understand rule three. He said, Brad, I own 11 car dealerships. One stole is one sold. And to this day, go to his house in Clinton, North Carolina, and he'll have a GM product, he'll have a Ford product, and a Cadillac product, and the keys will be in the car. So, if you're on the land and need some transportation, Clinton may be a good stopping point for you. But really and truly, Faircloth was an interesting fella in the political arena for me. He bought me the first day I worked for him, too. We drove from Clinton up to Greensboro, North Carolina. We stopped in Chapel Hill at the university and stopped in the bookstore, and he bought me Leffler Newsom, History of a Southern State, which was the preeminent textbook on North Carolina history at the time. And this is 1983. There are no cell phones. And every night we were on the road, I had to read a chapter in that book. And then the next day, while we were driving and traveling, we'd review North Carolina history. So I got a master's degree, had a chance to go over all 100 counties, all 100 county seats, from Juan Chise to Manio, all the way back up to Matthews and Murphy. So I got a real education in North Carolina history. Faircloth got beat in the primary. I went to work back at WPTF, which is sort of the WSB of Atlanta. It's a news talk station, 85, 86 years old, now 50,000 water. And they assigned me to travel with Jesse Helms. So I was able to travel with Helms and report on his campaign when he was running against Governor Hunt in 1984. So that was truly an experience, too, the most heated, most expensive United States history, United States Senate race in the state's history. After that, went to work for the Commissioner of Agriculture, Jim Graham, who served for 36 years as our commissioner, elected commissioner, and then got in the newspaper business when I was 23 years old, started a weekly paper, first desktop newspaper publisher in the state, ran that for 3 years, sold it, and went to work for the High Point Enterprise, running their paper in Thomasville, North Carolina, where Thomasville Furniture is made, and then went to work in 1991, started my own shop here in Raleigh, and we just turned 20 years old, November 1st, 1991. And I developed my business along the lines that if you're running for state house or state senate or for county commissioner, the state of North Carolina has become so competitive that you really do need to invest in having a good website. You need to invest in having nice-looking direct mail because the public knows the difference between a good website and a bad website. They know the difference between a good piece of mail and a bad piece of mail. And the down-ballot candidates have really looked at a niche market and have done very well there. For example, a competitive state senate race in the state of North Carolina will cost you $300,000 to $400,000 to $500,000. And my father did congressional races for Charlie Whitley and for Walter Jones Sr. for that same amount of money in the 70s and the early 80s. So that shows you sort of the transformation of the cost, the business side of politics. So you do three or four Senate races and five or six state House races, and you've built out, you know, $1 million right there. And so that's sort of been my business model to doing the political consulting. And I love it. I enjoy it. It's something different every single day, whether I'm working on a corporate campaign or a coalition effort or actually helping somebody run for district attorney or district court judge.
Yes, well, in addition to campaign connections, I understand that you're a regular on a television program that covers North Carolina politics. Tell us the name of that and a little bit about that show.
Well, it's hosted by Tom Campbell. It's called NC Spin, and I'm on about every other week or every third week. And Tom's family and my family go back a long time. My father worked for Tom's father when he was in the television business in Greenville, North Carolina at WNCT. And I worked for Tom Campbell when he was vice president of news at WPTF and then Durham Life Broadcasting. And so Tom and my career paths have crossed each other along the way for the last 30 years for our families, probably the last 50 to 60 years. And it's just a real treat because we do a whole dialogue on the current issues of North Carolina. For example, this week we were talking about the debate over video poker and video sweepstakes and the expansion of the Cherokee gaming rights up in Cherokee, North Carolina. We were talking about the tax revenues for the state of North Carolina and what they're going to do with the Medicaid program. So they're topical subjects that we cover on a weekly basis. It's online if you want to be able to watch the program. If you're listening, it's www.ncspin.com. They have a streaming version of the show, and then it's on every television market across the state from Edenton and Elizabeth City, Greenville, Washington, New Bern, Wilmington, Raleigh, Durham, Fayetteville, Greensboro, Winston-Salem, High Point, and then Charlotte Market, Nashville Markets. So it's all over the state every Sunday morning.
Well, that's good that it's so well covered, not just one city like the Georgia Gang here is in Atlanta, and I don't think it's covered anywhere south of there. Well, I've asked a lot of questions on bio, but luckily I got my co-host on here every week with me. So I want to let them have the first shot at some questions about politics, and then I'll come back and ask some other things. Tim, why don't we just start right off at the top of the ballot and talk some presidential elections.
Well, yes, sir. That sounds good. Good evening, Brad, and welcome to our show.
Good evening. Thank you. It's a real pleasure.
Listen, President Obama won North Carolina by I guess we could charitably say, a mere handful of votes in 08. let's just get right to it. Can he win North Carolina next year? And do you know if the president's campaign is going to aggressively campaign there as they did before?
The answer is yes, he can win. The answer is yes, he is going to actively campaign. The president's already opened up 17 field offices across the state. They mm-hmm. have never left North Carolina. He's had an ongoing operation with full-time staff with Organizing for America here. Lindsay Seiler is his executive director. She's been on the ground in the state for about 3 years. His IT and his data people are here working in Raleigh. They've been running ads online for the last several weeks, recruiting paid staff to come into the state as data analysts to work with the voter file. So they are going to invest an incredible amount of money here in the state. The political question, from an infrastructure standpoint, they are organizing, they are putting staff on, they are running a full-fledged get-out-the-vote, hand-to-hand, door-to-door campaign. The political question mm-hmm. is, can he win the state? And all the polls seem to suggest that, no, he can't right now. There's some polls showing him down 9 points, public policy polling showing him down 5 points, and they're liberal-leaning Democratic polling operation, but very well-respected. Their numbers are very good. Wall Street Journal ranked him as the second most accurate poller in the 2008 election cycle and the 2010 election cycle. His numbers are impeccable. The problem that the president has and the problem that the governor will have all deals with our unaffiliated voter in the state of North Carolina. In 2008, unaffiliated voters equated to 22.3% of your total votes cast.
Mm-hmm.
In the 2012 election cycle, that number could go as high as 25%. The interesting thing that happened to Democrats in 2006 and 2008, independent voters supported Democratic candidates at the state and federal level on a 2-to-1 ratio. In 2010, that flip-flopped on us. And you saw the results. We lost Bobby Lethbridge. We lost the state house and the state senate for the first time since Sherman held the state capitol. So, you know, that was a culture shock for the Democratic Party. Have they been able to recapture and reconnect with those independent voters? The polling's telling us right now that's not happening. We're still seeing polling numbers that were released last Friday showing the governor with a 2-to-1 deficit again with independent voters, with most likely independent voters. And in the presidential poll that came out 2 weeks ago on Obama here in the state of North Carolina, the same trend. But I would submit to you this argument that Purdue can be 9 points down, the governor, she can be 9 points down, and Barack Obama can be 5 points down in the state. We wake up the day after the election, and they both won in the state of North Carolina. And the reason is infrastructure, that they're running a better campaign. They're doing a better job of targeting segmented and priority voters for them, whether it's young voters, whether it's independent-leaning voters. They're able to get out, knock on the door, go see them, go find them, communicate with them, get back to them, and drag them out to the polls in an early voting process. They ran a better operation in 2008 than the Republicans. And from all appearances right now, they're doing a better job of putting together the infrastructure right now to compete in 2012. So it's really going to be interesting to watch.
Okay. So we have listeners on here from literally all over the country. And so they will get the lay of the land there. Which portion of the state must President Obama do well in order to win again?
That's really an excellent question. The state, of course, is segmented into three geographic areas. The eastern part of the state runs from I-95 east all the way down to the Atlantic Ocean. The Piedmont runs from I-95 west all the way up to I-77, which is a corridor that runs between Elkin all the way down to Charlotte. And that's basically the Piedmont, the central part of the state. Then in the western part of the state, it's west of 77, including the far southwestern where Cherokee, Macon, Clay counties, and then Buncombe County and Asheville, Watauga County up where Appalachian Boone, Appalachian State University is. the growth that we've seen, historically the states had an east-west symbiotic political relationship. There was, in the 1930s and 40s, it was even called the Shelby Dynasty, because the movements out of the rural regions of the state had a partnership where we'd have a governor from the eastern part of the state and the western part of the state every 4 years. And Jim Hunt, Terry Sanford and Jim Hunt literally came along and shook up that dynasty. And eastern North Carolina, I always say that eastern North Carolina is a blood sport and it's a spectator sport in western North Carolina. You had Jim Hunt, Mike Easley, and Beverly Perdue, the last three governors from the state, all hailed from east of I-95. So where Obama's got to win, though, what's happening in the state of North Carolina is that our growth has built up along the I-85 corridor that runs from Raleigh through Durham, Greensboro, Winston-Salem, all the way down to Charlotte. And our economy's transitioned from a agribusiness and textile-related industries into more service economies, into more high-tech in the Research Triangle Park, and into banking and finance in the Charlotte sector. And there are basically now 15 to 17 states that will control 60-65% of your total votes cast. The president has got to win the metropolitan and the suburban areas around the three major TV markets in the state, the Raleigh market, the Greensboro market, and the Charlotte market. He's got to carry five metro counties around those markets and then the surrounding suburban. And as the race develops, if Newt Gingrich, for example, is the nominee, Gingrich is going to have a real hard time attracting your more affluent, higher income, moderate voter, independent voter, than perhaps a Mitt Romney would. So the dynamics that we're seeing in the Republican nomination are very interesting and intriguing right now. But the president, if he wins, he's got to have moderate voters. The other key demographic to watch in the metro areas and suburban areas are going to be white females, Democrat, Republican, and unaffiliated voter, 25 to 50 years old, with children in the household, with a higher than high school education, income levels higher than $2,000. They're real persuadable, they're real volatile voters in all the polling data that we're seeing, whether it's coming out of Civitas Institute, Elon University poll, or public policy polling, your three major polling organizations in the state of North Carolina.
Okay, well, I thank you for all that good info, and with that, I'm going to pass it over to Catherine for some questions. Catherine?
Hey, Brad, thanks a lot for being on tonight, and I hope you're enjoying the conversation. We always like having someone on from one of our sister states, our nearby neighbors.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to ask you about preparations for the convention and how the Democratic Party in North Carolina is, how well they're organized and how things are looking for the convention.
Big question mark right now. The convention's coming, whether we will be or not. The only convention that I've attended was down in Atlanta in the '88 convention, and so I'm looking forward to this convention in Charlotte. My sense of it is that they're still trying to get their handle around it. The DNC has really restricted how corporate entities and some of the lobbying groups that have traditionally given money to the Democratic National Committee, how they can interact and how they can contribute money. And if you're a major corporation, for example, in the fuel industry, BP or Exxon or Shell Oil, for example, have traditionally always donated money to both parties. And now the DNC is only taking money from community nonprofit foundations. So some of your major corporations that are headquartered in Charlotte, for example, Bank of America and Wells Fargo on their eastern headquarters, Lowe's Home Improvement, the donations that they're giving to the national convention are routing through their community foundations, which is interesting. They're slow on getting the rules propagated as far as what type of entertainment schedules that can go on, when they're planning caucuses, releasing the room. So from a tactical and logistical standpoint, people are beginning to get nervous because they're worried about how do I plan if I'm going to bring a group in for the national convention as guests, how are we going to interact with the DNC? And everybody's still sort of waiting on that. I will say this, the good news, they are staffing up. They took a number of staffers out of the state headquarters in Raleigh this week and have shipped them down to Charlotte. So they are diligently realizing that they've got to staff up and have the resources to be able to deal not only with the VIPs, but also all the other Democrat state party organizations that are going to have to deal with, and then all the corporate interest. So I think they're behind the eight ball right now. I think that they realize that they're behind the eight ball, but they're slowly getting it pulled together. And I think that it's going to be a great showcase for the city of Charlotte. I think it will be a great showcase for the state of North Carolina.
And how is the party in North Carolina, the Democratic Party? Is it pretty well organized? Are they pretty dynamic? Or
we really aren't. We've had two very weak chairmen. David Parker is an attorney from Statesville. Ended up following David Young, who was the county commissioner from Buncombe County in Asheville. And Young was extremely weak, very poorly organized, mounted an absolutely just dismal effort, personally investing the time and energy that we need in a state party chairman to mount a successful campaign last year. Mr. Parker has worked on the grassroots component. He is working on the fundraising component, but there's still concerns out there about his leadership and about the direction that he's trying to take the party and where we need to go. I would say the individual campaigns who are running for nomination or current office holders in the Democratic Party realize that if you're going to run and be successful, it's sort of every man for yourself. And there's a growing concern that the party apparatus, Democrat and Republican, is going to have less influence in the process as we move forward simply because of Citizens United and the growing influence of your super PACs and the influence that they'll have, whether it's the teachers, whether it's labor, whether it's business, private corporations investing dollars into the campaign cycle. So that's a real big question mark, and that doesn't have anything to do with David Parker's leadership.
I think that's a challenge that many state parties are facing, and I think it's especially the Citizens United problems. I think we're all facing that, and we just have to wind our way through it and figure out the best paths.
Really concerning is what impact is it going to have? You know, dollars that would traditionally go to the party apparatus, Democrat or Republican, are now going into these super independent expenditures. And that's going to be a real big question as we move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes it very hard to organize. Because in Georgia anyway, and I'm sure it's probably true in North Carolina, the party really is, even if they're not organized, they are a very strong organization because you have Democrats all over the state. You might not have as many as you'd like, but if we could get those people engaged, then you really do have a powerhouse. But if there's not leadership to make sure that happens, then these outside groups see opportunities and see that their only opportunities for electing the people they want to elect are to form these separate entities. So it's a challenge, especially in the economic times that we're facing. I think people have less money to, make contributions, so they're a little bit more careful about where they place it. I'm going to turn this back over to David now.
All right. Thanks, Ken.
Yes. Well, we've gone ahead and talked about the presidential race, but in some ways the most important race to North Carolinians may be the governor's race. What's going on with that presidential year election?
Well, it's going to be the big race in the state of North Carolina next year. Of course, in 2008, we had United States Senate, presidential, and the governor running. So we had a triple header. Next year, we'll just have a double header with Obama and Perdue on the ticket. Interesting, Perdue has come into the state in the worst economic times that you could have. When Mike Easley handed over the reins to her, we were $1 billion in the red. The stimulus money that came into the state, rather than creating a rainy day fund or putting some of the money aside for a rainy day fund, the legislature elected, the Democrats in the legislature, elected to spend the money and continue funding investments in our higher education and in the primary public school system, and continue funding normal operations. And we did it with basically a 1 cent sales tax increase and some strategic cuts. But that proved fiscally overburdening for the state, because we ended up back again in 2010 with another deficit, simply because you had a collapse in your revenue, both on personal income taxes and corporate taxes, as well as sales tax. So the governor's had her hands full from the moment she's taken office. The good thing you can say about Beverly Perdue is that at least she shows up for work. Mike Easley, the previous governor, you know, I have said on TV and I'll say here, is that Mike Easley's living proof that the state of North Carolina can go 8 years without having a governor. So, I mean, the guy, he's nice. He looks good on TV. He'll go down in history as the first television governor in the state, because I mean, he just that wouldn't show up for work. I mean, there'd go days and days where he'd stay over in the mansion and just never, you know, go over to the Capitol. So, you know, Perdue gets up at 6 o'clock in the morning. She's at work at 7 o'clock and works a full 12-hour day, usually 5 and 6 days a week. Now, can she win re-election? No, no. Traditionally, the leading Republican who will probably win the nomination without too much of a fight is the former mayor of Charlotte, Pat McCrory, who would be a centrist, moderate to conservative Republican coming out of the establishment of the party. He's got Tea Party support, but it's not real deep right now. And traditionally, North Carolina voters have not, you know, in campaigns where you've had sequels, i.e. the Helms-Gant race from 90 and 96, you know, the victor has always been the first victor. That may not be necessarily the case this time. Perdue's had some real political, real big hits the last 2 weeks. Three of her top campaign finance people were indicted by a grand jury here in Wake County for obstruction of justice and failure to report some campaign finance violations to the State Board of Elections, one involving the use of her first husband. Her first husband passed away probably in early 90s, 92, 93, was a prominent attorney in New Bern, North Carolina. His law partner was Trawick Buzzy Stubbs, and she was using Buzzy's airplane to travel across the state. They had some campaign violations on reporting the expenditures for the use of the campaign. It was about $28,000 in question. And then her campaign finance chairman, Peter Reichert, was indicted for apparently paying some staff who actually worked full-time on behalf of the governor but was paid under his corporate umbrella. So all this has played out. Those are the allegations. The indictments were made 2 weeks ago. The first appearances will be tomorrow in Wake County District Court, where they'll present the preliminary evidence. The judge will have to determine whether or not there's enough evidence to proceed on to Superior Court. We are hearing that Peter Reichert's probably going to make a plea bargain. Don't know what Julie Sitton will do, prominent attorney from Western North Carolina. And then Buzzy Stubbs has been telling people he's going in and plead not guilty, simply because Buzzy went to the State Board of Elections initially and said, you know, how do we go through the reporting process? Really wasn't given good the guidelines, and he's going to contend that it really wasn't his duty to report it. It was the duty of the campaign manager, and the people around the governor who were doing her scheduling process and doing the compliance with election law. The attorney, the district attorney, Colin Willoughby in Wake County, said repeatedly that the governor was not involved in that, but still you're going to have some side effects. There's going to be some collateral damage that's going to impact the governor as a result of those three indictments and how the legal system proceeds with that. McCrory has been doing a very good job of traveling across the eastern part of the state, building a network where he lost the election in 2008 because he lost his home county of Mecklenburg, and he also lost eastern North Carolina, strategic counties in eastern North Carolina that he couldn't afford to lose. And so he realized that the last 3 years, 4 years, man's been working very hard, diligently, building a network. He actually, for the first time in the state's history, a competitor outraised the governor in the last reporting cycle back in July. This, you know, past 3 weeks, the published reports have shown he's raised $350,000 with trips from Governor Christie out of New Jersey and Governor Jindal out of Louisiana. So they are flat putting on a campaign, and it's going to be a race. And it is McCrory's race to lose this time, because I really do believe, and the polls will show it, that he is going to be the front runner in this race. But I will also warn the listeners, don't never, ever count out Beverly Perdue. She is a tactical retail politician. She's mean and got the height of two elements. She's tough-skinned, tough cookie. She knows how to fight it out, and, you know, you can't ever count her out.
Yeah, and I think you mean as a positive. It's kind of like in sports. Sometimes people be a little mean at times because then they have a little aggression and can stand up for themselves.
Absolutely. And, you know, she is a fighter. And we'll get right down, you know, she'll get right down. She needs to. She'll get right down in the mud with you. You know, I tell people, if you work in politics and at the statewide level, for Jim Hunt, for example, I mean, people respected Jim Hunt because they knew, you know, he knew how to flay the fish. I don't think anybody was scared of Mike Easley. Mike Easley wouldn't, you know, if you hit him, he wouldn't hit you back. And if he had a staffer hit you back, then, you know, that really doesn't have the same effect. But now Perdue, if she can carry a sharp knife too, and if you come after, you know, you better kill her, because she can cut you right back too. I mean, she knows where to figure out the pressure points, and she's been in politics. She was a former state senator and former lieutenant governor, and she's a, you know, she can go with the best of them.
Yeah, I tell you what, we've got too many elections in the future to get into it tonight, but sometimes if we have a Sunday when nothing's going on, I want to have you back just to find out how Mike Easley actually ever won an election.
Yeah.
But like I said, let's keep moving forward. We know when you have your governor's race, you have your down-ballot races, and that's where you build your bench. And honestly, some of those offices actually have power that can help the people or hurt the people in North Carolina. What are some of the more interesting and competitive contests?
I think we've got a good stellar, we've got a good group of for the Democrats, a really strong bench. The Attorney General has a great pedigree, great resume, forceful leader. He's had some political problems recently with the State Bureau of Investigation and the management of the blood sample lab and how SBI has handled DNA evidence. He's trying to work through that. He's appointed a new SBI director, and he's trying to rebuild some bridges with the law enforcement community as well as the minority community, in particular the African-American community, on how some cases were handled. Very tactical politician, very smooth, very eloquent. Janet Cowell, our state treasurer, is an up-and-comer in the state party here in North Carolina. Wayne Goodwin, the commissioner of insurance, clearly has got a bright mind, very consumer-oriented, a populist politician from Richmond County and Rockingham, North Carolina, and Hamlet. served in the state legislature. He's going to be an up-and-comer for the state. The Lieutenant Governor, Walter Dalton, is very competent, very smart. The biggest problem that Walter's going to have is that if the primary for the governorship opens up, it's going to be extremely competitive, perhaps with the Attorney General or the state treasurer. So he may get in a very crowded field and feel some sharp elbows there. Another problem Walter has is that he may be facing an aging issue. He's in his early 60s right now. If he has to wait another 4 years to run for governor, he'll be in his mid-60s. And that'll be interesting on how people view that. But it'll also give him, it'll give him 4 years to build a stronger network across the state. One of our politicians who is on the downside of her career is the Secretary of State, Elaine Marshall, who's run the United States Senate unsuccessfully twice, but has done an excellent job as the Secretary of State, a really good retail politician. She served as the Secretary of State since 1996, and there's a big question. She's going to run for reelection one more time, and then that seat will probably open up. Our superintendent of public instruction, June Atkinson, the rumors and reports out in the media that she may step down. She served for the last 8 years as our elected state superintendent for public instruction. So you could see possibly some new folks coming in there, State Representative Rick Glazier from Fayetteville, State Representative Tricia Cotham from Charlotte have announced that they may be interested in that race. The Republicans hold the Commissioner of Agriculture slot, a council state position in the state. Steve Troxler is our Republican Commissioner of Agriculture, and the Commissioner of Labor, Cherie Barry, has held that position as Commissioner of Labor since 1996, I think it's 96 or 2000. So the Democrats are trying to mount campaigns on those two races. They're going to be competitive. And really and truly for your down-ballot council races, you're going to live and die on the success of how well the president does and how well the governor does. The Democrats will be mounting serious challenges for the state House and state Senate. As I said earlier, this is the first time since Reconstruction that the Republicans held the legislature for 4 years in 1894 to 1898, and then the Democrats took back control at that point in time, but a real long time, 120, 130 years. So they have felt how it feels to be in the minority, and the minority leader in the House and the state senator putting together efforts right now to retake the legislature. The big problem that you face is that, this is redistricting year and reapportionment. And the Republicans have reapportioned the lines, and he who holds the pencil draws the lines. And the Republicans have definitely made some shifts in the lines, and they set it up so that they could have a competitive advantage for the next 10 years. I don't know if the Democrats – I think the Democrats can pick up seats in both chambers. It's going to be questionable whether or not they can retake both chambers. There's a better shot perhaps in the state House than in the state Senate. But clearly, as the state continues to grow in our metro markets, as I mentioned, the three major markets in the state, the urbanization of the legislature is taking place with this reapportionment. Democrats are going to be competitive as we move forward, and I think they'll be able to retake the House, if not in 2014, clearly by 2016, just based on the change in demographics and the change in electorate, the increase in populations in our urban and our suburban markets.
Yes, well, you mentioned redistricting, and we got time for about one final topic. And, of course, along with the state House lines and the state Senate lines, the congressional lines were drawn, and I believe y'all also gained a House seat in North Carolina. What do the congressional seats look like for the next 2 years?
Well, you know, we were 66,000 citizens short. I think that seat ended up going to Utah. We had a big fight 10 years ago. We picked up a 13th congressional district in 2001, and we're going to stay there for another 10 years at 13 House seats. I think Utah actually got that additional seat that they were looking. But it's going to be bad. It's going to be real bad. If the Republicans did any damage to the Democrats, it was really with the congressional maps. You've got competitive races now with Mike McIntyre, the incumbent. They with his whole district. McIntyre is going to be really challenged to stay. He's sure western part of the state, Carolina 11. He's going to be really challenged to stay. His district's now like a 55% Republican performing district. So Shuler, he'll be able to raise some money. He's going to be the best candidate for the Democrats to try and mount a campaign. But it is sledding uphill. The other really interesting race, they double-bunked Brad Miller and David Price. And Brad Miller was the chairman of the Senate Redistricting Committee when he drew the district for himself in 2001, and he served the 2002 election. So he's been in Congress 9 years, going on 10, and he is talking about challenging the dean of the delegation, who is David Price. He was elected in 1986, defeated in 94 by Fred Heineman, and came back in 1996 and has served ever since. And it's going to be that's going to be the fight of fights for the Democrats in the state. Can Brad Miller, who's 55, 56 years old, take out the Duke University professor, former chairman of the party, former executive director of the party, served in Congress with the exception of one term since 1986, David Price. And that's going to be the fight of fights. It'll be a Raleigh metropolitan fight wrapping around from Chapel Hill back into Harnett County all the way down to Fort Bragg in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And you know, who's going to win that seat? That's going to be a real big question mark. But it's going to be it'll be an interesting fight. If I had to put bets on it right now, I'd bet on David Price. Just from a structural standpoint, with as Catherine was talking about, the organization of your Democratic Party and how that organization turns out. Both of them are seen as liberal Democrats. Another interesting fight, David, is the 8th district where Larry Kissel has served two terms. He survived last year, but he's going to face a rigorous challenge. Former Congressman Robin Hayes' chief of staff, Richard Hudson, from Cabarrus County, is running. He's worked in Washington probably for 10, 12 years. Very smart, very capable young man, a real rising star talent-wise for the Republicans in the central part of the state. He understands the legislative process. He's a darn good politician, too. He actually ran Pat McCrory's campaign 4 years ago, knows the organizational structure of the Republican Party, and I would bet he's hired Dee Stewart, who's probably the best Republican consultant in the state for a Republican primary, and I think he's going to be the front runner in that race. The other real interesting race in the state is the 2nd district, which is going to put Bob Etheridge against Renee Elmers again. And Etheridge is going to try and make a comeback. He got beat last year, primarily on the Patient Prevention and Affordable Care Act vote that he took. That health care bill, the Obama Health Care Reform Act, really hurt Etheridge, in particular in the rural regions of his district, Johnston, Harnett, and Lee counties. And Renee Elmers was able to capitalize on that and won that seat. So that's going to be another really interesting race to watch here at the congressional level in the state. And, that's going to be, you know, sort of the congressional map that we're going to be paying attention to next year.
Yeah, well, we'll continue to look at that race. And with all these races coming up in North Carolina, we'd love to have you on sometime in 2012 when all this gets a little closer, including the convention.
We'll be more than happy to. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks again, Brad.
Y'all have a good
night. Thank you, sir.
Yep, that was Brad Crum from Campaign Connections and North Carolina Spin, our special guest tonight. Well, we got just a little more time tonight. And I guess the one thing that came up over the weekend, we had talked a few weeks ago of how exciting the new Texas maps were and how it gave Democrats a chance to pick up a few congressional seats in Texas, which we kind of thought was a unlikely place to look for multiple targets. But now the Republican Attorney General has requested the Supreme Court to step in and stop these maps. And, of course, they've the Supreme Court's put a stay while they look at it. Tim, what can you tell so far about this case?
Well, you just said that the first and main thing is there is now a temporary block on the interim maps that were drawn by a lower court that has excited everyone so much. That means, first of all, that the primary, which was scheduled for legislative and congressional seats, I believe on March the 6th for Texas, are probably going to be delayed by maybe as much as 2 months. And, you know, there's no deadline for a ruling from the Supreme Court. And so everything is just on hold, David, because if you don't know what district you even live in, well, you can't very well file to run for office. This is at least, and I've just got to say it temporarily, a big win for Republicans out there who really did not want to live under the new maps that were drawn by this lower court.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, if they don't like the maps, then things, you know, won't get worse out of the Supreme Court. Also, it's a win for incumbents because if your challenger has less time to put their organization together, that benefits you because you're an incumbent. You're assuming you're going to run somewhere. So that's another help to you. And then, but I will tell you another loser, if they have to go ahead and have their primary election for president, they're going to have a vote. And then if they come back later and have another primary for all the other elections, that's two times they're going to have to hold elections.
Well,
not a lot of states
you made a good point. You made a good point because apparently the primary for all other races is going to go forward.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
For the presidential race. I mean, because they've got
all the local races. It'll be the legislative and congressional districts that
have to stop
in their tracks.
Anything with maps. Yeah, if it's the county lines, it's your county clerk and sheriff and all that. Which all of them's got to run. Yeah, because whether or not you hold an election for president or you hold an election for statewide dog catcher, as long as every county's involved.
Right.
You have to open the ballots, and you have to hire the people and whatever it may be. You have to count them. And so the costs are the same. So while I think March may be a little early for some of these elections, if the people of Texas say, look, we want to save money by and be more efficient by having one date, then that's what they wanted, and I would abide by that as a citizen, if you will. Catherine, chime in on this.
Well, I'm surprised that they are – postponing the primary and qualifying and not just going back to the old maps.
I don't think they can do that legally, I wouldn't think, and I'm not a legislative scholar, but it seems like because the population's changed, they're going to have some type of new map.
Right.
Yeah.
And we move beyond.
In Georgia, for example, we ran on the old maps from 2000 to 2004. It wasn't until 2004 that we were running on the new maps.
The problem here, Catherine, is that the Supreme Court will be testing the validity of the latest round of maps, which was drawn, I believe, by 2-3-judge federal panels. And that's what they're going to be talking about, and they're not really interested in anything else. And like I said, unless they give an expedited ruling, I mean, we're here in December. It looks to me like that primary is going to be delayed, and there ain't going to be any way around it.
Yeah, hopefully, what the judge, you know, maybe the Supreme Court will say is, you know, we like the idea of judicial redistricting. and independent panels, and, you know, they'll uphold the maps because, of course, it may be kind of like in football. You have the officials on the field, and a lot of times the replay officials like to back them up because they're
all
officials.
But, David, the problem is when will they get around to doing
exactly.
that?
Oh, certainly. How fast will they do it? Will they take care of it? And, of course, you got some people that we may not trust as much, like Antonia Scalia and Clarence Thomas, which we have to believe might feel were a little more political than your average judge.
But here's another thing there. Both of those three-judge panels consisted of two Republicans and one Democrat, I believe.
Well, good.
They overrule them. You know, I don't know what to say. Nobody knows what the Supreme Court's going to do here. Nobody can even hazard a guess.
Well, who knows? Stranger things have happened. Well, we're in recording phase, so let's go ahead. That tells us that if we're finished with the discussion, we need to close it up and come back next Sunday on the Kudzu Vine.
Okay, good night, everybody.
Good night, guys.
Good evening, everybody.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.